where we are today as we continue our journey with Paul through the second missionary journey. And just to review a little bit the geography of it, the map is before you, I doubt if you can see it from where you're sitting, but in your book it is page 1688, and you may just follow along with my pen here. As usual, this is page 1688, as I said. It starts over here at Antioch, which is ascending church for the three missionary journeys of Paul. And it goes overland past Tarsus, where Paul grew up and probably attended the university as a youngster, or as a young man, I should say. And then probably touching all these cities from his first missionary journey, Derbe, Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, before meandering across western Turkey, as Acts 16, verse 6 to 10, I believe it is, shows the Spirit forbade them to go hither and yon and there, and finally they end up in Troas, where Paul received the call to go to Macedonia. And we got up to Philippi when time caught up to us, chapter 16, and we were introduced to Lydia, the seller of purple, who befriended them and who was baptized with her whole house. We met the jailer, who also became a person of faith with his whole household. And then we stopped at the point where the magistrates were called upon to apologize and to let Paul and Silas go on. And they insist, of course, that they be treated with dignity after they had been treated so badly by the magistrates earlier. So this brings us then to Acts 17 and following as we continue the journey. You'll notice on the map they move rather rapidly from Philippi to Thessalonica to Berea, which is close to the Thessalonica, and then much further down here to Athens, which was sort of the cultural capital of Greece at the time, and then a little west of there to Corinth. And those are the main points on the second journey. On the way back to report to Mother Church, as well as to Antioch, they stopped briefly at Ephesus, but didn't stay very long. They would come back on the next journey. So we're up to Acts 17. Once again, Paul is able to find a synagogue in town, as he does in most of the places in Greece, except for Philippi, where there was no synagogue. Apparently there were very few Jews in Philippi. And there he proclaimed Jesus as the Christ or the Messiah, which we find as a formula on a number of these visitations here. This is an important thing to say in the synagogue, that they who actually have been looking for the Messiah or the Christ, to identify Jesus as the fulfillment of their hope. Well, you see that there is a strong following there, and so much so in verse 4 that the Jews become jealous and they get some rabble-rousers to make trouble, and then eventually the attempt is made to drive Paul out, and they can't find him right away, but they did find, verse 6, Jason, the man who kept them at his house, and they forced him to give some kind of security, and Jason had to agree to move them on elsewhere. Now you notice in verse 7 that Paul and Silas are accused of acting against the decrees of Caesar, which is something that we've seen repeatedly charged against the apostles as well as against Jesus. So they move on to the next place, which is Berea. There too, verse 10 tells us there was a synagogue in that city, and what distinguishes the Bereans is that they were zealous Bible students. They checked out their Old Testaments, their Hebrew scriptures, to see whether the things that Paul was proclaiming to them really were so. And so Berea is always held up for that particular positive characteristic. Here too, as at Thessalonica, Paul and Silas were persecuted and driven onward. And, at Athens, the next stop, Paul seems to be all alone. And this is a very dramatic kind of confrontation that happens at Athens. You'll notice, of course, Athens is the philosophical as well as religious capital of Greece, even though perhaps Corinth was a larger city at this particular time. But the intelligentsia claimed Athens as their great city, and it is here that Paul talks to all kinds of people, but starting as usual at the synagogue in the city, but branching out from there also to talk to the townspeople and preaching Jesus and the resurrection. Now, some of the local people apparently thought that Paul was proclaiming two deities, Jesus being one and Anastasis, the resurrection being the other. But that was not indeed the way Paul meant to come across. So they wanted to hear more about him. And you've probably seen the detail about how cleverly he addressed the Athenians, who were always seeking some bit of new knowledge as, well, in relation to something that was already in their pantheon, as it were. Well, they worship all kinds of gods, but just in case they missed somebody, they wanted also to make sure that they were had all their bases covered, so there was an altar to the unknown god. Now, as Paul begins to proclaim to them on kind of a philosophical level, you notice he doesn't stay there very long. These are people who are steeped in philosophy, but at the end of his speech, after Paul had indicated that, you know, all mankind has a common ancestry, and we're all made of one blood, he goes on to show in verse 29 that the former viewpoint was one of ignorance, because gods are not made of wood and stone, and now the times of ignorance are past, and God would one day indeed judge the world by one whom he has appointed and assured through raising him from the dead. So here too, Paul, even in Athens, proclaims the resurrection as the basis for faith. And verse 32 points out that this teaching was not received by all, by any means, because most of the Greeks felt that once you die, that's the end of you. But there were some who did believe. And the fact that Dionysius and Damaris are mentioned here, and others are also converts, suggests that at least he did have the beginnings of a church here. Luke doesn't say that exactly, but we do know that a church was established in Athens, and today it is a city with many churches. And from secular sources, we find that Dionysius probably was an early leader in the Church of Athens. So what distinguishes Dionysius here is that he is an Areopagite. Now, what is the Areopagus? There are several definitions of that term. One probably refers to the hill itself where Paul preached, namely Mars Hill. The Greek word for Mars is Ares, and Ares was a god of war, just like for the Romans, Mars was a god of war. So the Pagus, the hill of Ares, Areopagus. Others have defined the term, the Areopagus, as referring to that body of people who judges speakers. It was a very elitist kind of a body, and for Paul to have converted such a person would suggest that his message must have been very powerful, and of course the Spirit was at work. And one of the Areopagites, by the name of Dionysius, was converted, plus, of course, Damaris and others as well. So that's the story of Athens. He seems to be all alone there until the others would join him at the next city, Corinth. And while Athens may not look like very much of a victory for the gospel, yet, in the larger scheme of Luke, it is a significant kind of a forward move. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time with you on this kind of thing because it's the kind of study that probably most of us don't engage in. But some years ago, when I did my dissertation, my thrust was to deal with the you can't see what's going on here, but the beginning and the end of the missionary journey's narrative has a lot of things that are parallel kinds of information pieces. And as you move from the beginning And from the end toward the middle, you have speeches here like at Antioch and later at Miletus at the same point, and the very midpoint of the missionary journey's narrative, according to the poetic structure, which is a chiastic structure, by the way, is indeed the Areopagus address. So the three major addresses are at significant points, but the Athens speech is at the middle, which suggests again that we have here a very significant midpoint between Paul's movement, well, the apostolic movement beginning at Jerusalem, through Judea and Samaria, and also through Athens, the Greek capital, to the Roman capital, to Rome itself, which is, of course, the high point of the gospel that, you know, the intended mission was fulfilled in Rome. So Athens has some significance, indeed it does, although perhaps without the poetic aspect, we may not see it quite as profoundly as otherwise. But let's go on to Corinth. Corinth is in chapter 18. You will obviously want to note that Aquila and Priscilla surface for the first time here, and they are tent makers. And because of this, immediately there is a relationship with Paul, who is also a tent maker, and that's how he supported himself in at least many of the cities of Greece, where, like with the Corinthians, he did not take any of their money because they would pick him apart. You know, they would think that he is trying to, you know, take advantage of them. So he supported himself, and he also got some contributions from places like Macedonia, which also he appreciates, and we see him commenting on that later. So Aquila and Priscilla, tent makers, they join him. They were expelled by Claudius, as verse 2 says, who was the emperor at the time, who chased the Christians out of Rome in kind of a mini persecution at that time. Once again, verse 5 and following, we see Paul and his company, including Silas and Timothy now, proclaiming that the Christ was Jesus. Now, we'd seen that at Thessalonica. We see it here. We'll see it again in, Ephesus later, saying that the Christ, the Messiah, is Jesus. So that was, you know, a very important part of the message as he's trying to reach out to the Jews in the synagogue. But, as usual, verse 6 points out that the Jews in the synagogue persecuted him. They reviled him. They opposed him. And his statement here, as he leaves, "Your blood be on your heads. I'm innocent. I'll go to the Gentiles," is one we see several times in the book of Acts. We had seen it at Antioch of Pisidia, where the Jews persecuted, and he said he would turn to the Gentiles. Here again, at Corinth, he says he will turn to the Gentiles. And finally, when we get to Acts 28 at Rome, where he talks first again to the Jews, his countrymen, and some believe, but most do not, and so he gives them the indictment of the prophet Isaiah that, you know, they have hardened their hearts, and so I will turn to the Gentiles. So that's a frequent theme throughout the book of Acts. Rejection leads to the advancement of the mission as he goes elsewhere to, you know, bring the gospel to new places and to new peoples. Well, he doesn't go very far. Here in Corinth, he goes next door. He goes one house away to the home of a man named Titius Justus. And then we're told that Crispus, verse 8, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord. Something very special and unique here in Corinth, as we have not just one, but two people who were synagogue leaders who apparently came to faith. Now, the Jewish synagogue leaders. Now, this one is obvious because Luke says so, verse 8. The second one is not obvious. In verse 17, Sosthenes. Sosthenes was the synagogue leader, ruler, after Crispus. And he got beat up badly by his fellow Jews. And Luke doesn't tell us why, but I suspect, and this is very reasonable to suspect, that he was beat up because he refused to say bad stuff about Paul that wasn't true when they brought Paul before Gallio, the proconsul, and therefore he got beat up. And how can we say that he became a convert? Very easy. When we get to 1 Corinthians, which we will tomorrow, you will see that Paul, as he writes to the Corinthians, in his very opening lines, refers to the epistles being from him and Sosthenes, you know, to the Christians at Corinth. So apparently that same man who is a synagogue leader is so highly regarded by Saul, by Paul, that he is mentioned in the introduction to the Corinthian correspondence later. So two rulers of the synagogue are converted in this place. And while Paul may have been discouraged while he was here, God braced him up by giving him a special vision in the night. Verse 9 talks about that. And he was told to not to be afraid, but to speak up, not to be silent. He would not be harmed here in this city, and he stays a year and a half teaching there. So those are some of the main things in Corinth. And verse 18 of chapter 18 speaks about Paul then taking leave and going back toward Jerusalem and Antioch. And he takes with him Priscilla and Aquila, and he deposits them in Ephesus, and then he continues himself on to Jerusalem and to Antioch. But before he goes to Ephesus, he does something special at the seaport of Athens, Centuria. This is mentioned in verse 18 at the end. He cut his hair. He cut his hair. Now you wonder why would he cut his hair and make a vow. And I am a firm believer that it is because he recognized that his life was always in mortal danger as he preached and as he got persecuted and beaten up and chased from one place to another, and that there is a good chance that he wouldn't be back because, you know, he's heading off to Jerusalem and Antioch, but Antioch would love him, and Jerusalem, you never know. So he cut his hair. I think it was probably, and I'm only conjecturing, that it's his way of saying to the Lord, if you bring me back here, this is my goal, to bring a contribution of money to the saints in Jerusalem so that they will indeed understand that the Gentiles really are people of God, even to the point of sending money to the poor saints in Jerusalem. We know, as a matter of fact, this is what happens on the third missionary journey. He takes the collection. We know this is what happens from 2 Corinthians. He writes to these people to collect their monies because he wants to have them accompany him to Jerusalem. So from later details, we know that this is what something would happen. This is the only way I can make sense out of his getting his hair cut off and making a vow. But otherwise, why would Luke mention if it were not for some special religious purpose? But you can conjecture all you like, and this is how I'm conjecturing. And it makes good sense, I think. So verse 21 then says, I will return to you as he leaves Ephesus. That's his first major stop on the way to Jerusalem, where he leaves Aquila and Priscilla. If God wills, I will return to you in Ephesus. They wanted him to stay a long time, but no, he wanted to get back to Jerusalem. And he does. Verse 22, he lands at Caesarea. He goes up and greets the church. That's the church at Jerusalem. You can supply that. And then we went back to Antioch. You know, you go up to Jerusalem and you're down from Jerusalem anywhere else. And that's simply fact. I mean, this is how the Jews thought. Jerusalem is the holy city. You go up to Jerusalem, even if you're on the Mount of Olives, where you have to go down to get to Jerusalem and up the next hill, which is lower than the Mount of Olives. But still, you're going up to Jerusalem because that's the center of the universe, okay, Jerusalem. You go down to Antioch, even though geographically it may be, you know, elevated reasonably in a similar way. Well, it probably wasn't quite as high up as Jerusalem, but you go down from Jerusalem anyway. All right, that's the end of the second journey. Now we come to the third journey. And while perhaps you don't need this, we will quickly throw the map on the screen anyway, just to start to refresh our memories. And there it is. Third journey, again, starts here at Antioch. It goes overland to the places where he'd been before, in Galatia, and it spends most of its time at one location, Ephesus, where he was several years, and that's really the import of the end of chapter 18 and all of chapter 19, the ministry at Ephesus. Now, of course, he doesn't stop there, so trace with me what happens he is very interested in catching up to Titus, whom he had sent ahead, but Titus didn't come back, so he goes to Troas. Maybe he'll be there. He wasn't. So he goes across the water to Macedonia, and there he catches up with Titus. We'll have more on that tomorrow when we talk about Corinthians. And then he continues to go to visit all the churches of the second missionary journey that are in Macedonia and Achaia. And this is where he takes the collection on the third missionary journey. And we get that very firmly established when we read the letters to the Corinthians, 1st and 2nd Corinthians. Now, once he gets to Athens and Corinth, you would think he would be in a hurry to get that money to Jerusalem. And he was. But he couldn't sail across as he had done after the second journey. And the reason is there was a plot by the Jews against him. And, you know, if you got money bags and you got big-time cash in your satchel, this can happen. And so because he was afraid of what might happen sailing across the shortcut, he backtracks his whole business, and then we have the details of his stopping at Troas, and we get a very interesting detail about that. And later, he stops at Miletus on the way back overland as he makes his way gradually to Jerusalem. At Miletus, he has a major speech. So we'll talk about that. And after the third journey, he gets to Jerusalem. And at Jerusalem, he delivers the collection. And that's well established in the book of Acts, the collection that he brings to Jerusalem. It comes out in one of the speeches, I think it's before Felix, the governor, that he mentions that. All right, now where are we in the Bible? We're back to Acts 18, verse 24 and following. And there is the name Apollos mentioned for the first time. And Apollos is one of the fellow missionaries who apparently had not been working with Paul up to this point. And he is not with Paul either at Ephesus. He seems to have been in Ephesus in the time when Paul wasn't there, but then he was kind of ushered off to Corinth before Paul arrived. But what it does say about him is that he was a very eloquent man, but he didn't have the full understanding of everything about Jesus yet. He knew the baptism of John, but Priscilla and Aquila needed to bring him up to speed on a few other things that he hadn't yet fully received. So then he goes on to Corinth, and then Paul arrives at Ephesus in chapter 19, while Apollos was at Corinth. Now, I think a few days ago we spoke about various kinds of special outpourings of the Spirit, first in Jerusalem at Pentecost, and secondly at Samaria, at the time of Philip when Peter and John came down there. This is among the Samaritans, which was such a surprising thing to the people of Jerusalem, but this is God's way of saying, indeed, the Samaritans have a place in the kingdom as well. And then thirdly, we saw it at the Cornelius home, at a Gentile home, and now we have it totally outside the land, in a Gentile land, where once again, the Spirit is present in a unique way to authenticate the mission for those who might say that this is not of God, that God should be at work in Gentile lands. And we have that little detail here that after they were baptized into the name of Jesus, they had only been baptized into the baptism of repentance by John, but now into the baptism of Jesus, they were filled with the Spirit, and there were about 12 of them, and they spoke in tongues and prophesied. Let me come up for air for a moment, and if you have anything up to this point that you want to delve a little further, fine. Otherwise, we will continue with 19, verse 8. Now, you notice in verse 8, there is mention of Paul going into the synagogue for 3 months, speaking boldly, and he meets some resistance, as usual, but as at Corinth, after he had to withdraw from the synagogue, he continued to preach, but in a hall, the hall of Tyrannus. And verse 10 is very interesting. You may remember from chapter 16, verse 6 to 9, in that little paragraph, Paul wanted to go to Asia to preach, and the Spirit prevented him. Instead, he went to Troas and got the call to go to Macedonia. But now we are told that all of Asia heard the word. So again, we have one of these hints here that the mission is always at the Spirit's direction. And now, in the visit to Ephesus that Paul had at the third journey, all of Asia hears the word. And when we come to our epistles to the Colossians, in a couple of days, well, when did they hear the word? Probably at this time. We don't have any record that Paul personally ever showed up at Colossae, but this probably comes under this particular verse here, that all of Asia heard the word. And one of the people who was a convert at Ephesus probably established the mission in Colossae. Now we come to a humorous little story, and I don't know if we need to spend a lot of time on it, but at least it's interesting, about people bringing handkerchiefs and aprons so that Paul might touch them and that they might be cured of their diseases as a result of touching these same articles, and of some itinerant Jewish exorcists trying to use that power as their own magical power, and well, they get bruised badly because a demon that they tried to expel turns on them. It's very funny because, you know, Paul had cast out demons, but they tried to do the same thing, and the demon said, "I know Paul, I know Jesus, but who are you?" And so the demons overpowered these sons of Sceva, who tried to cast out demons in order to take the power from Jesus' name, and they were wounded, and they had run away naked. And I guess the whole point of it is here that as with Ananias and Sapphira, you know, fear came on all the people at that time. Here again, we're told fear came on all of them at this time. You don't mess around with the name of God. You don't mess around with trying to play games with God or with the power of God or the name of God. So the sons of Sceva run away naked because the demons stripped them and wounded them. And in verse 19, we're also told of the great effect upon those who were selling books and trying to purvey the magic arts, that, well, Ephesus decided that this was not the right thing to do, and they burned these things at a tremendous cost to themselves, 50,000 pieces of silver. So Paul's preaching must have been very, very powerful in Ephesus for this kind of thing to turn around. This will cause trouble later, but meanwhile we have an interlude. This is one of these places where Luke comes up for air, and it's in verse 21-22. Before we hear about the after effect of Paul's powerful preaching, we have one of these notices about the direction of Acts. Paul, in spirit, resolves that he will go to Rome, but first to Jerusalem by way of Macedonia and Achaia, but then I must go to Rome. We have a few other hints as we move along the rest of the way in Acts where the Spirit promises him that he will get to Rome in times that are difficult times. So this is one of those hints here. He must see Rome. He had determined he would, and later the Spirit also encourages him to go to Rome, which is also where the gospel, where the book of Acts ends. Now, verse 23 and following, the matter of the silversmiths. Demetrius is the principal character here. He sees that their business is eroding because of Paul's preaching, and the riot that ensues has to do with, well, Demetrius and his silversmiths stirring up the mob, suggesting that the temple of Artemis is in danger because Paul is preaching against the gods, at least so they say. Artemis. Artemis was probably the most famous god. There were many gods that were worshipped in Ephesus. She was the goddess of fertility, also of the chase, but here I think in this place it was mostly fertility that she was seen to represent. And one of the seven wonders of the ancient world was the temple of Artemis. Now her Roman name was Diana, Diana, but the Greek name Artemis. So Demetrius and company got the people all agitated to assume that Paul's preaching would cause them to lose the worship of Artemis, who was their principal goddess, among many other gods and goddesses, and that they would soon lose their place. So the riot is intense. It takes place at the theater. The theater in town housed 25,000 people. Typically, in Asia, whenever there was a theater in a large city, there would be enough seating so that one person out of 10 of the whole city could show up at the same time. So if they had 25,000 seats, there would be 250,000 people, and that's the estimated population of Ephesus at this time, 250,000, which is a lot for the ancient world. It's one of the great cities of the Mediterranean world. So you can imagine the scope of this riot. It was huge. And if you follow through chapter 19, you will notice that some of Paul's companions got dragged into the theater. Gaius and Aristarchus are mentioned by name. They're minor characters in the book of Acts, but nevertheless, some of Paul's company was dragged in, and Paul wanted to go in, but he was persuaded not to go in. And one of the Jews wanted to speak up, Alexander, probably to say, well, you know, Paul is not a real Jew. You know, he's probably going to make the difference between what a Jew is and what a Christian is. Up to this time, you know, Christianity was tolerated by the Romans because the Romans did not distinguish between the Jews and the Christians, because the Christians came out of the Jewish family, as it were. But Artemis, in his attempt to speak, was foiled, and he was, stopped by the great uproar that came. The hero of this whole uprising is a town clerk who tells them to quit this rioting, because otherwise we could be in big trouble with the Romans and lose the kind of respect that we have in Rome. And the courts are open. We have proconsuls take it to the legal process, and that's how you get a hearing. So Paul escapes from his life with his life here, but this was a very horrible experience. And later he writes about having fought with the lions at Ephesus, and we don't know exactly where that happened, but Ephesus, he got out of it, but it left some very bad memories. Chapter 20. This is now the end of the third journey taking place. He has one significant thing still to do, and that is to take up the collection. And that's what chapter 20 starts with, by showing people from various locations as he goes to Macedonia. And from verse 4 onward, he mentions seven different people who accompany him with his collection. And if you read it carefully, you will notice that there are people from each of the three great missionary journeys. You will see, for example, there is Gaius of Derbe and Timothy. Timothy came from Lystra. That's from the first journey. There are people from Thessalonica. You have Sopater from Berea and two Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus. You don't have to remember their names, but the important thing is that you notice that they're from the second journey. And there's also people from the third journey, the guys from Ephesus, Tychicus and Trophimus, the Asians. So each of the journeys is represented, and I think this was a powerful statement eventually to Jerusalem, that from the various Gentile churches, and some Jews included too, of all three journeys, they're the ones who take up this collection for the saints in Jerusalem. So having done all that, taking up the collection, verse 6 continues with another we section. So we sailed away from Philippi. Here Luke apparently is again putting in his signature. We sailed and came to Troas. You'll notice as the journey details continue that for at least the first part of the journey, they're in two companies. Paul doesn't go with the whole group, but they split up into two groups. And again, Luke doesn't tell us why, but I think we can kind of figure it out. They have all this money, and the plot had already been made, and that's why he didn't sail across to Ephesus directly to begin with. And so they split up into two companies before they sail over to Troas. And later, as they leave Troas, again, they split up for a while until they join together and go the rest of the way. So this is probably an attempt to keep the plot from happening and developing. And Luke doesn't go into detail on it because he's got bigger fish to fry than to talk about all those kinds of details. But he gives us a clue. It's almost like with Jacob returning to the land after he and Esau had been at enmity for 20 years, and Jacob split up his company for a similar kinds of reasons, I guess, because he feared the meeting with Esau. Now, you have one interesting thing happening at Troas where he stops. He's on his way back now. There's a man who falls out of a window. His name is Eutychus. Eutychus. That always amused me, a name like this. The Greek word tike means fortune, and the prefix eu means good. Good fortune. Now, what's the good fortune about falling out of a third-story window? He fell out of a third-story window because Paul was preaching on and on and on all the way up to midnight on the Sunday night. And so I don't think that's a warning to preachers that they shouldn't preach too long a sermon. But anyway, Eutychus fell out of the window. And good fortune was that Paul was there and was able to bring him back to life again. He was taken up as dead. Whether he was totally lifeless or not, it sounds from the reading that he was left, he was considered dead, and Paul is able to pronounce him as living. So this is probably one of the two instances of Acts where Paul is given that special grace. The other one, of course, at Lystra, where he was left for dead after he was stoned, and his friends came and they found him under the rocks still alive. He goes on the next day to the next city. Anyway, the story of Eutychus is here. More details about their travels till we get to verse 17, Miletus. It's at Miletus that Paul delivers his farewell address to the church. And why at Miletus? We have no record of his being there before, but it's a place where the ship would stop. And apparently, as Luke explains, he wanted to save some time by not stopping at Ephesus again, because they wouldn't let him get away right away, because you know he had this long experience with them. So he calls the elders of Miletus to come, the elders of Ephesus to come to Miletus, and there he delivers his farewell address. Now, let me just, in just a few words, summarize this address. It's an address of a number of emphases. One of them is exhortation. He exhorts them to continue in the faith, and to be alert to the dangers that would come to them, as in the future, fierce wolves would seek to destroy the flock that is there. It's also a time of bidding farewell to the church at Ephesus through these elders. And he seems to suggest that he would not see them again. Indeed, as he makes his way to Jerusalem, he is warned three times through the Spirit that great trouble would await him if he went to Jerusalem. But like Jesus, who three times mentioned to his disciples, you must go to Jerusalem, so Paul felt he must go to Jerusalem to complete his mission. So it's farewell, it's a time of exhortation, it's also a time of defense, a time in which he defends his ministry among them and says, I worked day and night among you, and did not spare energy with you. It didn't shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable. My goal was to feed the Church of God. And so he, on those three points, basically posits his speech. Well, we see a very tearful farewell as he leaves them at the end of chapter 20. And then we come to the sailing to Jerusalem in chapter 21. Now, there's a few stops on the way, but the one that I'd like to focus on primarily is in verse 8 and following of chapter 21, when he comes to Caesarea. At Caesarea, whom would he meet? Well, remember back in chapter 8 when Philip left the eunuch? after he had baptized him. And it says that Philip was seen no more, but he was found in Caesarea. Well, apparently he's still here at the end of the third missionary journey, and Paul sees him, as well as his four daughters, who also were prophesying. And so Paul stays there for several days, and once again Agabus resurfaces. Now you remember Agabus had that prophecy about the famine that led to famine relief in Jerusalem. Here he prophesies to Paul that he would be bound. He takes Paul's girdle and binds himself up with it, and he says this is what's going to happen to the owner of this girdle if he goes to Jerusalem, because everybody begs him not to go to Jerusalem. But Paul says, what are you doing, verse 13, weeping and breaking my heart, for I'm ready not only to be in prison but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. And when he wouldn't be persuaded, they said, the will of the Lord be done. So Paul is intent, just like Jesus, who turned his face to go to Jerusalem. He would definitely get there despite the obstacles. He sees that this is his call to deliver what he's carrying, namely the collection, and to make a powerful witness to the people in Jerusalem. Well then, he arrives in Jerusalem, verse 17 and following. And whom should he see there? Well, James. Acts 15, we had met this James, the brother of the Lord, as the one who was presiding over the Apostolic Council, and here he is still in charge of the church in Jerusalem. And so he checks in, delivers the message of what happened on the most recent journey, and we can also be assured that he delivered the collection that he had taken, although not a lot is made of this at this point by Luke. Later, when he talks to Felix, Paul mentions that he had brought an offering to Jerusalem for the saints. So we may assume this happened here as well. All right, I trust you have read this chapter and you know that they brought false charges against him there. And they tried to suggest that he was defiling the temple by bringing Gentiles in to the courts that were beyond the court of the Gentile. It was not true, but for this reason, they seized him and even wanted to kill him. That brings us to the end of chapter 21, where the tribune, the Roman tribune, who had his headquarters very close to the temple, saw the insurrection that was taking place, and where the Roman soldiers came to the rescue and literally carried Paul away from his Jewish persecutors. Paul asked to speak to the Jews, and he is given permission. He talks to the tribune in Greek. He's very surprised, and he thought that Paul was some kind of a revolutionist from Egypt. He wasn't. And then he speaks in Hebrew to the people, and they listen because that's their language. Even though they can understand Greek, they're impressed by the fact this is a Jew, after all, and he still speaks our language. All right, so Paul had established his citizenship meanwhile with the tribune, and he is allowed to speak, and he makes defense. Chapter 22 is one of those great defense speeches where Paul recounts his early years, where he had been in Jerusalem studying under Gamaliel, who was probably the most distinguished teacher of his age. And so it was good to drop that name here in Jerusalem, which Paul does for the first time in the book. We had seen Gamaliel introduced earlier in connection with the early days in the Church of Jerusalem as a very wise counselor. But he also talks about his conversion on the route to Damascus. He talks about Ananias, a nice Jewish name, a prophet that they might respect, who had commissioned Paul to be a witness to the Gentiles. And there's that dirty word, Gentiles. When he mentioned that he was called to go to the Gentiles, literally the place fell apart, and they were going to kill him again. Away with such a fellow from the earth, they said, and the tribune rescues him once again, and he's going to beat him up, which is what you do to get truth out of a guy, right? You beat him up good. Paul says, you can't beat me up, I'm a Roman citizen. And of course, the tribune is surprised. Paul gets rescued from getting beat up, and he gets treated more civilly. and he is brought before the council. That brings us to chapter 23. Paul is brought before the council or the Sanhedrin. And the man who is in charge here, the high priest, is named Ananias. Not to be confused with Annas, the father of Caiaphas, although the names are similar. Apparently there were a lot of people named Ananias. There's Ananias and Sapphira, there's a prophet Ananias in Damascus, and here's the Ananias, the high priest in Jerusalem. How did you go with Ananias' fate, I don't know. But anyway, Ananias treats him rather gruffly, and he commanded that Paul be struck. Now, of course, that would have been a violation of Roman law, but Paul is obviously very gentle with the high priest. He doesn't press charges. He does tell him it's contrary to the law that he ordered me to be struck. And, well, of course, then he's very polite to the high priest. But as he talks to the council, he succeeds in dividing them by witnessing to the resurrection. As you'll notice in verse 6, the Sadducees and the Pharisees are caused to fight with each other because Paul identified himself as one who is there because of the resurrection, which the Pharisees approved of and the Sadducees did not. And once again, he has to be rescued from this place because these Jews are fighting with each other. And at that night, 23 verse 11, we have this encouragement that Paul receives that he would indeed go to Jerusalem. The angel of the Lord comes to him and tells him that he would go from Jerusalem to Rome, where he would complete his mission. So he has a lot of reassurances. Verse 12 and following speaks about the plot against Paul's life by 40 plus people. As you look at that story, it's very impressive, isn't it? The system of Roman justice. When, you know, they are told of this plot by Paul's young relative, they not only protect Paul, but notice they provide 470 militia people, you know, bowmen, horsemen, infantrymen, the whole works, 470 people to protect against 40, and that very night they usher him off toward the seacoast, and with 70 cavalrymen on the second day, he arrives safe and sound in Caesarea. So that's the kind of law and order and justice that we find in the Roman world at that time. And Paul is advantaged greatly by that. So he arrives at Caesarea. Well, we have a couple of trials taking place, and I'm going to run over these rather quickly because there's a lot of similarity here. Chapter 24 deals with his being in the presence of Felix. He is the procurator, holds the same office Pontius Pilate had in earlier times. And Felix, while he had Paul speak to him a number of times, nevertheless, when his term was up, kept Paul in prison, even though he should have and could have released him, because Felix was expecting a payoff. He heard from Paul that he was arrested in Jerusalem, even though he had brought a big offering for these people, and so probably Felix was hoping to cash in on some of that. It didn't happen, and he left him in prison. That brings us to chapter 25. He's before the next procurator, Festus, and Festus, too, comes off a little bit weak. He caters to the Jews. He tries to win their favor. He tries to persuade Paul to go to Jerusalem for a trial, and Paul says no. He knows what will happen on the way to Jerusalem, that they plotted for his life if he went to Jerusalem. And so he appeals to Caesar. And this is what happened before Festus, the appeal to Caesar. So Festus is in a predicament. What shall I do? Chapter 25 talks about it. He doesn't have a charge to write up against him because he knows Paul is innocent, just as Felix knew he was innocent. And fortunately for him, Agrippa, this is now Agrippa II, Herod Agrippa II, came to visit Felix and to congratulate him on his arrival from Rome. And so Agrippa hears him. Agrippa is a Jew, of course. He is in charge of the northern region of the kingdom. And he is familiar with the controversies of the Jews. and Paul speaks to him. So in chapter 26, we have Paul's defense before Agrippa, and where he once again goes into great detail about his early life. Agrippa would understand these things. It's kind of like that speech in chapter 22 where he talks about also his call to go to the Gentiles, about how he met Jesus on the road to Damascus and a number of other things. His commission to go to the Gentiles was, of course, the thing on which the speech ends, as had the one in chapter 22. And Festus then, the procurator, said, "Paul, you're mad. You must be crazy. Talk like you do. And your great learning has made you mad." And Festus is told that he is speaking, Paul is speaking the sober truth. None of these things were done in a corner. And then Paul turns to Agrippa the king and says, "Agrippa, don't you believe the prophets?" And Agrippa takes a dodge and says, "Well, do you think in a short time you're going to make me a Christian?" So he sort of puts Paul off. You notice the zeal of Paul. He even wants to convert the king and the procurator, but again, they sort of put him off. Well, the end of chapter 27 is to suggest, I should say 26. 26 ends with the king and Festus agreeing that Paul is innocent and he wouldn't have had to go to Rome, except he appealed to go to Rome. So now they had to send him to Rome because that was his right as a Roman citizen to appeal to the emperor if he doesn't get justice at a lower level. It's kind of like our Supreme Court. You know, he got a chance to talk to the Supreme Court by going to Rome. As we look at the journey, chapter 27, we notice here this is one of the most, well, it's generally agreed by people who study early literatures that nowhere in classical antiquity is there a sea voyage that is described in such careful detail and with such skill as Luke does here in chapter 27. And the interesting thing about the sea voyage is that at several points, Paul is giving advice to the captain as to what he should do. And usually the captain says, "No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to stay here at the island of Crete." Paul says, "You ought to, because you're imperiling everybody's lives if you don't." So they sail and they get shipwrecked out at sea. After a couple of weeks, they land on the island of Malta. So again and again, you see in chapter 27, Paul is giving advice, and he is being disregarded. And finally, as we come near the end of their being tossed around the sea for a couple of weeks, Paul has a vision in the night from an angel that says, "Take courage, don't be afraid, you will come to Caesar after all." And Paul is able to communicate that to the leaders of the ship. And so they, when the ship gets wrecked and gets caught in the sandbar, the captain does not allow Paul to get killed. There's a lot more detail here, but I'm making time here by moving on more quickly. They're all able to land safely. No life is lost as they land at Malta. Now Malta, as I think if you looked at the maps, you could see that it is very near their destination. It's a little bit south of Italy. Here is a little island of Malta. I'm on page 1708 in your Bibles now, the map there. After they sail past Crete, they come after a couple weeks of stormy weather to Malta, and there they stay a little while. That brings us to chapter 28, Malta. What happens there? As they land, they are received with kindness, and as they're standing by the fire, warming themselves after they'd come out of the cool water, a viper fastens to Paul's hand, and the natives are sure that he must be a bad man. Even though he's been rescued from the sea, he's now going to drop dead because, you know, this viper got him. Nothing happens, so he shakes the creature into the fire, and they assume, once again, as we've seen before, that they thought Paul to be a god, and, well, he wasn't, of course. But Paul does some wonderful things for these island people. He cures the father of the head man of the island. Publius was the chief man of the island, and his father had fever and dysentery. Paul prays for him, and he's healed. And so when they get sent off after the storms subside, and after they stay a while, they're given all kinds of presents, and they make their way to Rome. Verse 14, is one of the most low-key climactic verses you will find anywhere. After 27 and a half chapters and all of the issues that Paul found on the way to the destination that he had and that the book has of arriving at Rome, we have this very simple statement after they came to Puteoli and stayed there 7 days. And so we came to Rome. So we came to Rome. It's almost like, you know, all in a day's work. So they did come to Rome, and Paul is taken there into custody, where he is given a lot of freedom. He had a guard to watch over him, to protect him, but he's given a lot of liberty. And the chapter concludes with his speaking to the Jews. Some believe, some do not. And for those who do not believe, Paul has this quote from Isaiah the prophet that we saw in the gospel a few times as well. Verse 25 says, the Holy Spirit was right in saying to your fathers through Isaiah. It's about the people hardening their hearts and being blinded in their eyes, lest they turn and be saved. So he will turn to the Gentiles. Verse 29, he will turn to the Gentiles. The very last verses of the book deal with Paul having two full years there at his own expense, allowing people to come to visit him and being able to preach and teach freely about the kingdom of God and about Jesus without any hindrance and most openly. So the book ends on a triumphal note, and the mission of Acts 1 verse 8 to go from Jerusalem to Judea and Samaria to the ends of the earth is fulfilled, and that's where Luke ends it on that high note.